Good morning, friends. I'm excited to be here with you this morning. I was thinking this week on this topic, one of the things that we learn really early on as we're children, and one of the things that we teach really early on to our children is how to put the world into order, right? A really big part of the way that we function in our daily lives is according to order, right? Some of the ways that we learn to do this when we're kiddos is we learn to match things together, right? We learn early on our right from our left. We teach kiddos, where's your right hand? Where's your left hand? And we teach them about shapes in the world, and we teach them manners, and there's all of these different categories, right? That we teach kiddos how it is that things go together in the world, right? First, they're kind of pieced together all over the place. We go, where's your nose? And they learn to tap their nose. Where are your eyes? And they learn to tap their eyes. And you go, where's your face? And sometimes they look at you like, what's a face, right? But as we grow older, we find different ways. We mature and we graduate to different ways of ordering in the world. And I remember as a kiddo, we used to play this game to help us with the order of things. And it was, one of these things is not like the other. How many of you have played that before? Maybe a Sesame Street version if you're a boomer from the 70s. There was a fun song that came along with it too. So I'm going to invite you to play this game with me. Are you ready, Crit Singers? And we're going to put some pictures up, and we're going to see if you can find what in the picture does not belong. One of these things is not like the other. Let's see what we got. Okay, I don't know if you can see this one very well, but this is a, do you see it? What is it? Clorox. So the next time you're shopping for milk, make sure that you grab milk and not something else that will whiten, right? It will do something for you. Okay, one of these things is not like the other. And this, all the things are red though, and they're all tiny and so cute. But what's the difference? There's a strawberry, and strawberry, you cannot be a tomato. Okay. So next one. One of these is not like the other. It's really close. Oh my goodness, these creature ones, I just died looking for these pictures. Can you see what it is? It looks so close, right? Yeah, it's a little kitty cat, okay. Let's check out the next one. Oh, this one's a little bit hard, but can you see it? You see the dog? Okay, good. Do you see it? Do you see the cute little dog? It's over here in the corner on their left there. It looks really fluffy, right? It looks really fluffy, just like all the other fluffy creatures. Do you see them now? It dimmed the lights for you. Oh, you go. They're all fluffy. Okay, let's see. Do you have another one? Oh, if you're a fan, this could get a little hectic, and it might be, don't get your feelings hurt, but one of these is not like the other. Do you know which one? maybe. Okay, great. That's a little obvious. One of these is not like the other. We are all little Batmans, except when we're not. Okay, he missed the memo. All right, and so in our story today, we will do similar things as we hold this painting up there. Even from the story of today, as we read it, we made some natural assumptions about the characters in the stories. 1 Kings chapter 17, 8 through 16, right? And we read about this prophet Elijah, who was instructed by God to go to this town of Zarephath to see this widow who is going to be providing food for him. And I don't know if you did this right away, but I did this right away, I certainly did, was I assumed that certain characters were going to be the protagonists in the story, and that others were just going to be supporting characters in the story. And what does this do for us? So we assume that maybe Elijah was going to be the prophet, so obviously as a prophet, God is going to favor him. And so we have this picture here that kind of depicts that kind of assumption, right? It is the widow who's going to be attending to him, and that the woman obviously a widow described in their time, we'll get a little bit more into that in just a second, would simply go and she will be the one to provide for him because she obviously has less as a widow is described in this time, right? And without even trying, like I said, I made Elijah the one that stands above the woman. But what I'd like us to check out, then this is not necessarily terrible, right? But there's something that happens within our minds that then eventually will trigger something for our emotions and then I believe tends to create and color a picture for the way that we see the world and that also colors and creates a picture for the way that we think that God sees the world. So sometimes these categories and the way that we classify things, especially when we get into the temptation to classify communities and or people, then it gets really tricky, it gets kind of sticky, right? And it can be limiting. And is that what we learn from the moment that we open this ancient book of Genesis, that we serve a God and we're created by a God of limitations? I'm challenging that today, that I think the answer is no. So maybe instead of seeing this picture of Elijah, what if by the time we got to the end, we saw a different picture that could perhaps be that Elijah was not the protagonist of the story, but in fact, it was this widow who is the protagonist of the story, because she is the one, even though has nothing as described in scripture today, will be the one to give the most. So these two pictures, may you think about them as we continue to chat today. Thank you for playing that game for me. You did really well. Did you get your score? How many out of how many? It's okay, Pastor Deva will have these pictures afterwards if you need to try again, okay? Don't be hard on yourself. Okay, so the way that society was organized in Israel and in the ancient Near East made it so that widows, particularly orphans and elderly, were part of this larger category, this category of the poorest and the most vulnerable in society. So our story is unique, right? Because God sends Elijah, this prophet, and this man, he's already been through quite a bit, right? He's got some history. We're in chapter 17, so 16 chapters before this. And we have Elijah who's been, he's favored by God, yes, but he's been fleeing already for his life and trying to get away from exile. And now God has led him to enemy territory, Zarephath. It was this part of the city in Sidon, like we read, which was notoriously known for its pagans' worships of Baal. So you can say Baal or Baal. Some of you asked me about this last Sabbath. Pastor Devo has a permanent accent, so everything that he says will be funny all the time. But you can say Baal or Baal. I think in the Greek it's a short A. So we have this this place notoriously known as pagan worship of Baal, this pagan god, right? And Elijah was not only on enemy territory, but he was also in deep destitute himself, right? When you're fleeing a country, when you're trying to get away from people holding you in exile, you're probably not rolling around in the nicest car, in the nicest ride, right? So he's running around trying to keep a low profile, and he ends up in this place. Zarephath has its own history as well. It was once a place of much promise. It was the Phoenician commercial capital known for exporting goods, specifically for exporting wine, for exporting grain, for exporting oil. And now the city of Baal, ironically, was in dire constraints because, as scripture describes, there was a drought in the land. And we learned this a couple verses before because the narrator is telling us about this Wadi River where Elijah was just before and how it had dried up. But it was near the Jordan River. How could there be this massive drought in the land? I just know that if I were reading the brochure for this trip and if this was my mission from God, I would have handed it back and said, no thanks God, that was good though, right? I would have handed it back in a heartbeat. The entire formula is a disaster.
And then to top it all off, God sends Elijah and he tells Elijah that you're going to go seek a widow. So this would mean that Elijah was looking for a woman who had little to no resources, since the sole provider of her family, we are assuming, had died. And even though the laws of the Pentateuch, they attempt to provide the safeguard for widows in their community or other unfortunate, vulnerable members of society, one of the things like allowing them to glean from the land, you know, an example of what she was doing, this woman and her son, they were part of this larger condition in their society, which today we're going to call this word precarious, this precarious condition. They found themselves at the lowest end of the poverty scale. The Old Testament, it underscores these different levels of life of the poor and how they're this result of the exploitation of society. So society has created these levels, and then there are these different ways that they too categorize the poor, okay? And so these words, they help us understand not just the economical status of the people, but also the social status of the people, which is a little bit different from the way that we understand it now, but stay with me in their time. And so there's three words that we're gonna learn today, okay? This helps us kind of move through the idea and give us some context to who this widow was and their community. The first one is doll. And this word doll describes a poor peasant farmer who suffered from economical hardship, right? But they were not completely desolate, since they assumed that they were still able to make sacrifices, as it was described in Leviticus 14. But even farmers experienced their own moments of precariousness, like in Genesis 14, where we read about these emaciated cows. This was an example of a graphic representation of the powerlessness of this class at some times, the doll. Okay, and then we have this next category is Ebion, okay? Ebion were described to be a little bit more desperate in need, right? They were likely landless day laborers. So they had work, but they didn't own any land, right? No rights to the space where they probably lived. And finally, there was this last category of Ani. And this affected the humble and the poor who struggled to survive, and mostly that they had to fall back on the generosity of others, or oftentimes the lack of, right? So the widow would fall into this last category. And although the scripture only describes to us that she had minimal resources, I think it's enough to assume when we're reading through this that this definition where she has others to fall back on, I think it's absent from her life. And perhaps this is what led her to make this confession that we eventually hear that she makes to Elijah, because she was preparing for her last meal with her child. And she describes to Elijah, after he asks her for water, he describes to her, I have only a handful of meal. Check out your hand and pretend that you've got only a handful of meal. And then she says, I've got this little oil, this little jar of oil. And then she expected that she was gonna go home and bake this. This would be the last meal, the last supper, if you will, with her child. And that after this, she expected that she had no more resources and that they would potentially starve to death. And perhaps this idea that there was nothing more that she could do, that there was nobody else that she could ask for or a call for resources on, or nobody that she could fall back on, that was the last drop for her and her son. And one author describes that the widow's precarity is living under a death sentence, right? So, what does this word precarity mean? It's not a word that we often hear, right? But it is quite significant. I need the help of a little one today. Maybe one or two little ones. Do you want to come up here? You're not supposed to make eye contact with the preacher if you don't want to come up. Rule of thumb. I guess you need to learn this in college. The habit comes real strong in college. I just need one. Let's see. You want to come up here? Carson, you want to come up here real quick? Okay. Thank you. Cool. Okay. Okay, buddy. Do you see this paper bag right here? Here, come here. You can stand over here so everybody can see your awesome tie. Okay, buddy. It matches his pants. P.S. He's very well-dressed. Good job. Okay, what if I told you, okay, everything that I'm gonna tell you is truth, it's fact, okay? And I just want you to tell me if you think I'm crazy, if it's possible, if it's not possible, why or why not, okay? What if I told you that in this bag, there was enough food to feed everybody in the sanctuary today? And we could even feed anybody who's at the university and possibly everybody who lives down Sierra Vista. What do you think?
No.
No? Yeah, why, he said no, very, very sure. Okay, so why do you think there's not enough in this bag to feed everybody? What do you think? What do you think has to be in here in order to be enough for everybody? Is the bag too small?
Yeah.
Do you think the bag needs to be bigger? Or maybe the food needs to be bigger?
The food needs to be bigger.
Okay. So what if I told you, okay, why don't we open this? Why don't you check out what's inside? And then tell me after you see what's inside that maybe it might be enough. What is it?
Seeds.
What is it?
Seeds, I think.
Yeah, there's seeds. So in fact, let's see, there's actually a ton of seeds. Let's actually see what's in here, okay? That's squash. It's very healthy. This is a radish, okay? These are peppers. These are tomatoes. Do you see this? These are green beans and broccoli and corn. Now, do you believe me when I say there's enough in here to feed everybody in this room?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think we need to do with these seeds?
Give everybody one?
Yeah, right? Okay, you can actually keep those. Enjoy. Thank you. Sometimes we find ourselves in this sliver of an idea of, is there enough? In this small paper bag, at first glance, it doesn't look like there's much for anything. His first reaction to say, no, there isn't enough, is most likely most of our reactions to a paper bag that offers something more for everyone. Is there enough? The Latin root of precarious means obtaining or asking or praying, it says. This fits well with the definition of our society today because precariousness is always a signal that help is needed desperately. If your life is precarious or you are in a precarious situation, things could become really difficult or even dangerous for you, right? Is what some definitions say. So when we think of this precariousness that we tend to gravitate to, this overwhelming state that our society is currently in, I know that when I was reading this story, I know that it reminded me of the very condition that we see developing over and over and over and every day just a little bit more. When I was first reading this, I immediately thought of the growing percentage of poverty in California alone, right? In California alone, 23.5%, which is the highest in the entire United States. We are the concentration for poverty in the United States. In this America, we are the concentration of poverty, and it grows. And then a staggering 35% of the population of this poverty lives in one small concentration of a city. Can you guess which one it is? Starts with an S, ends with a Bernardino. San Bernardino. San Bernardino is the 35% of California's population, lives below the federal poverty line. This is crazy making, right? How can it be that we have access to so much resources ourselves, and yet there is this place near most of our homes? It's a 30-minute drive from Riverside, right? Just over the freeway. And we go hiking in these places, and we do beautiful things beyond, but there's this place where there is not enough. We look, and what we see is a paper bag. And actually, people have moved to San Bernardino. They have tried to live in areas like Loma Linda and Riverside, in Corona, in Orange County. And it turns out that those cities have nothing to provide for those who are in desperate need. And so, even though it has become the largest growing population for poverty, it is where the people who need the most find their refuge, because they know that at least they can survive there. When I thought of this word, precariousness, I immediately thought of this. If you want to learn a little bit more about the situation, there is a video called San Bernardino : Broken, and you can check that out online if you'd like to learn a little bit more about the statistics, right? But we talk about these people as statistics, but it turns out that these people are real people. They are like you and they are like me. And for some of us, we are the people, and we haven't moved to San Bernardino yet, right? But for some of us, precariousness comes to us not just in the physical state of the things that we don't have. Sometimes it digs deeper into our spiritual state, into something more, into our mental state, into the state of our families. Precariousness, although first coined to identify a social and economical status of a community, is more than that. This week, as many people come into our office, there was a woman that came into our office, and she didn't really look too different from any of the other families that we see. She spoke only Spanish, and so I sat with her. She told me her name was Maria. And she came in, and I sat with her, and we did what we usually do with the several families that come in and that need. We usually have them fill out some paperwork. We figure out a little bit about their story, because we want them not just to be a person that's processed. We want to get to know them just a little bit better. And so, as the Spanish speaker of the office, Austin was not there, me pusieron a hablar con la señora, y yo con gusto hablé con la señora. Se llamaba María. So María sat in our office, and she told me about her story and how it was that she had ended up in Riverside herself. And it's interesting, because you sometimes sit down with people and you can't imagine the history that they've been walking around with, right? And so she tells me that she has been running away from this abusive relationship with her husband. And she thought that she could afford this move, and she has four children, and one day it just clicked. We can't live this way. And so she thought, we're going to move from this place. They lived up north. And so she said, we're going to go over to Riverside, because I have a sister here, and we can live with her until we are back on our feet. And so she tells me that this last year, when her hopes were for some sort of prosperity, some sort of opportunity for her and her children, it has been everything but that. So they moved in with her sister, and that worked for a little bit, but it immediately became too uncomfortable, because her sister, too, has her own children. She has four, and her sister has a few other children of her own, and they were also struggling financially. So not just financially, but also the house was small, and it was starting to get super cramped, and in order to preserve the relationship with her sister and her family, she decided, okay, that's fine, we'll find something of our own. And so she sold a few of the things that she had, jewelry that she had from her marriage, and she was able to pawn those things. And finally, she said she came across this man who heard her situation and said, I'll rent you this old RV that I have sitting in a lot. And she said, I'll take it. I'll take anything. And so she started telling me about her life with her four children living in this RV, in this lot. And she said to me, that they recently have had a harder time in the last couple months, and she's not really sure what to do with the situation because she's new to this much need for her and her family. And she was so grateful to this man who had allowed them to have this home. She said, but sometimes it gets hard because we don't actually have electricity. So we have to figure it out. But we're so grateful that we have a roof over our heads. And then she told me that sometimes when things start to get rough, one of the things that she does, and she has the kiddos help her do, is run around the lot and try to find wood so that they can make a fire to cook their food over. And I sat there as she was saying this to me, and I thought, wow, what a familiar story. I have heard this somewhere before. Precariousness, it is real for them. And sometimes, though, we are like this woman, whether it is that we are scrounging around our yard for these physical pieces of wood to light the last fire for our last meal. Sometimes it's deeper for each and every one of us, and we are no different from Maria. We are Maria, and Maria is us, and her precariousness is our precarity. And these deep physical ways of that precarity works into our lives, it then unleashes the way that we believe that the creator of the universe views us because of the way that we see the world. So maybe you prepare for the worst. Maybe you're scraping from the bottom. I know when I was a student, and I don't know if this was your story as a student, but I know when I was a student, there were moments where I just didn't know if I was gonna make it. You know, you just weren't sure. I think I worked 3 or 4 jobs my entire undergrad career. It was all that I knew. I didn't know any better. I didn't know that you could go on vacation during spring break. That was new to me. But for me, that was an opportunity that I had. I also knew students who would get to the end of their quarter and they would realize that they had no more funds for anything and that they would have to go back to their country and start all over again. But you're 1 quarter away from finishing this fantastic degree, and to them, they couldn't see past that. And some of you know these people. Some of you sponsor some of these kiddos on the other side of the street with these miraculous stories, and they scrounge around to find what resources they can gather to pay for this education that they love so much. And sometimes they don't make it, right? Sometimes we don't have someone to fall back on. And sometimes it has nothing to do with our finances. Sometimes it has to do with our relationships. Sometimes we're just at the end of a relationship and we just don't know if it can be salvaged. Or sometimes we are just completely at the end of our spirituality with God and we don't see where God is present. And we might just be done. Perhaps the widow that we're talking about in this story is experiencing a little bit of all of these layers of despair because she was at the end of her rope of hope. Elijah, in a sense, was in a really similar place of disparity on his own too, because in this moment, he would need for her to get on the same page as him. He needed her just as much as she needed him. When he asks her for a drink of water, she must know that he is pretty thirsty, and she doesn't really hesitate. But to her, in the state of drought, I mean, we've experienced sort of that state of drought, right? But never to a point, but to her, I imagine that this cup of water was just as important as the handful of meal, this bread just as golden. But she doesn't question him on this, and she goes and she's gonna get him some water. But when he asks her for food, she shares how bad it's really been. And from this man, he knows what this life has been like to live from day to day. For him, it comes from this word of hope that he has heard over and over, this good news from God. And so he shares this good news with her because maybe if they can get on the same page, then something can be worked out together. And he says to her what we often hear Jesus repeat in the Gospels, "Do not be afraid," he says to her. And although Elijah speaks to this woman, it might seem absurd when he tells her this, right? And when he's asking her for resources, a woman who has barely nothing, it might seem like the most ridiculous situation. You're asking me for something? I have nothing. But maybe what Elijah is trying to do for her is exactly what God is trying to do for Elijah the whole time. Inviting this widow to participate in a different reality of God's promises. And he's assuring the widow that she can easily afford to honor God's obligation of hospitality, providing for her guests first, because Yahweh has already set things in motion so that she will have this unending supply of meal and oil until the rain comes and restores the land. And in this transaction of hope lies something even deeper and more sacred. Elijah must help her see that there is more to come, because it is only when she sees that there is more in front of her that he can also reap from the more that is in front of them. Elijah has to help her. And in this way, it is not Elijah who becomes the protagonist of the story, it is the widow. Because he is dependent on how she responds, because soon he will be partaking of everything that she has. And their story will continue a chapter after this. And her precarity quickly becomes his precarity, and that is not bad news, because they both must triumph together. And Elijah hears God's voice, and he attends to what God is asking him to do. But what we often miss is that the widow also heard God's voice. And even though she paused, and even though she's not the chosen prophet, she does respond. And they both have an opportunity to leap at a chance where they can trust God again. Maybe for Elijah, it's an opportunity to again trust God. Or maybe it's for the very first time, this new God that she doesn't know, because her God was a pagan God, but she knows of Elijah's God. And so maybe it's a moment for her, for the first time, to live a different life. And the hard work for both of them, though, will be to realize that they have to do this together, and that there is no other option but together. When you and I measure what God is doing, we tend to measure it by what we see. And we think according to this natural man, right? We think according to who we are and what we see in front of us. And we tend to measure God's supply, one author says, or our confidence and hope in God's supply by what we see. And when we do this, we are walking in sight rather than by faith. The question we need to ask ourselves is, do I tend to look at the human conditions as a basis for my confidence, or do I see them through God? Just as surprising as the widow of Zarephath, her intervention in the life of Elijah would have been, so sometimes you and I find ourselves surprised and blessed by those around us who we would least expect it. And they become a source for our own survival. The widow probably wouldn't have guessed that her circumstances would have been prophetical to this prophet. But the tables are turned. And Elijah, even though over and over experiences God providing for him, he probably couldn't have imagined that he was going to be serviced by a widow with almost nothing to offer from a life completely different from his, worshiping all of her life a different God that was not his. Everything unsacred to him, sacred to her, and she would be his sacredness, saving his life. Maria, this week, when she came in, she said to me, "Today I woke up and we had nothing. We had run out of everything. We had no food, and It was one of those days where I also had run out of a way to get the kiddos to school. And what that meant was that they would also not have that meal. Some of our kiddos in our community, you know, sometimes the reason that they have meals is because they get to go to a school that provides it for them. What an important service. We had no food, and she said, I felt horrible. They like school. I could imagine that they like school, she said. And I was done. I had nothing left. And when I thought it was all over, she said, I was just ready to throw in the towel and just give in. I had no more jewelry to pawn. I had nothing. She said, my sister knocked on the door of the RV, and she said, I have some food for the kids. I'm going to take them with me. And I think that you should go to this church on the corner, because somebody told me that they will help you there. And she looked at her, and she said, but who are they? Have you been there? And she said, I don't know. I have no idea. But somebody told me that if you go there, that they will help you. And Maria was in a little bit of anguish, she told me, because she had been to several churches already that week, and that many of the times that she had walked away empty-handed. And so she wasn't quite sure that she wanted to go yet to another church to see if the people in this space would find something for her. But she said she went anyway. And so she came in and she sat down, and as she was talking to us, she said, I don't even know if I believe anymore, but I'm in disbelief now because I'm walking away with something. And there was this moment where we felt, you know, I felt this huge pride for our church, and there was this moment of realization that it wasn't even so much the things that we were giving her, it was that we were attending to her as a community. And that we do this every week, right? We have over 150 families, Norm and his team, on this side of the street. I mean, they interact with all of these families, but it was also this starking reality that we serve over 150 families a week. We serve over 150 families a week from our local community. There is something broken in our community that 150 different families every week still need so much. That was hard for me to swallow. And then I read again Elijah. Sometimes we feel ashamed of this problem, right? Maybe it's more a reflection of my own resources and feeling that shame. And God says, I'm not calling you to judge the situation. We're calling you to be present with the situation, to be present. And sometimes we do this in the different parts of our lives. We'll shamefully hide the things that we are ashamed that we are suffering with. Whatever category of things that in your life are currently happening that are hard to speak out loud about, we do this and we keep those issues to ourselves. But the 150 families that physically show up are a representation of probably the 150 families that sit in our own midst with a different case of precariousness. But what if we could learn something from this extension of hope from Elijah to the widow and from the widow to Elijah? What if we could change this state of mentality that this precarity was the worst thing? Maybe we turn this into a moment like God had with Moses. What is in your hand? And let God show us what we can do with what is in our hand, whatever level of pain or precarity or lack of resource or of scarcity that we have. One author puts it like this: when we're talking about difficulty, it is difficult to change the most mentally. Whole people see and create wholeness wherever they go, but split people split up everything and everybody else. By the second half of our lives, the author says, we are meant to see in wholes and no longer just in parts. We are meant to see that we are part of a wholeness of God. A God that seeks to create wholeness for the world. Wholeness in us and through us, like Pastor Austin prayed today. So no matter where you are in your life or no matter how much you have, you are a part of the wholeness of God. One author writes about a drought in Africa and says that children are the first to suffer in a drought. And yet, the drought is not partial to any age group or any social status or suffering. And neither is precarity of any sort, right? But we can be part and partial to seeking wholeness, not just for ourselves, but with each other. And may this week, may you find yourself in more possibilities of rethinking our wholeness together. And may that, whether it leaves you just a little bit disturbed, be a way for us to claim that there is more to this picture of God. Pray with me. God, we thank you for the story of Elijah and this widow. We thank you that it gives us an opportunity to think differently about the state of the world, of our own lives, God. And that even in moments in which we feel there is nothing left or our community is running on its last leg, God, that you have something more for us. That we can look to our right and we can look to our left and that there will be someone there because you will provide that, God. And that you will continue to help us to redefine the ways that we see the brokenness in our community. And that instead of looking through the lens of scarcity, we look through the lens of wholeness as we are a part of a whole God who creates in love an opportunity for so much more. We thank you for this immediate community that value so much to care for each other, God, and may we find more ways to share that in the world, not just this local community, but to the world around us, God. And we are humbled by an opportunity that you are our God. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.